I'm not pulling my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for the Drive to Work at Home edition. Okay, so I'm using my time at home to interview people. I'm trying to continue that. Today I have Aaron Forsyth with us, and we're going to talk about Lorwyn. Hey, Aaron.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
Okay, so I'm going to set a little, for the audience here, understand what was going on. So this was back in a time where I was sort of training you to be the next me and trying to teach you how to do design. So you had led a couple sets before this, but this was the first large set that you led, right?
And this was back when large set meant like fall set.
Fall set, yes.
There typically weren't other large sets.
Right, I guess so now.
It was always like the large sets were these big things that were supposed to set the tone for the whole year and have follow-up content, other small sets that came after them. So yeah, I had led Dissension. That might have been it. A core set or something like that. But yeah, this was the first big deal.
And the big thing about this was the kind of, I mean, what the fall set was all about back in the day was you were setting up the world, you were setting up the whole year. There was a lot of figure out what this is and, you know, what it wants to be. So there was a lot of structure making that's a big part of it.
Right. At least in principle, that's what should have been happening. I think at different points in time, we were better and worse at that. Like sometimes we'd just be leaving the large sets, would kind of leave the small sets to fend for themselves. I think we were trying to do a little more structure here this year, especially because once we decided we were going to do large, small with Shadowmoor.
Well, Lorwyn is pretty early in me taking over as head designer. And one of my big things was I didn't want to leave small sets abandoned like we did. And yeah. So I was doing a lot more like block planning. And so
this set came out in 2007, just to actually put it in
yeah.
context.
But also we worked 2 years ahead. So like this, we worked on it like 2005. I took over in like 2003. So like this was relatively early. I think it's the third block that I oversaw. Like I did Ravnica, then I did Time Spiral, and there was Lorwyn.
Do you remember the code name for Lorwyn?
What was the code name for Lorwyn?
Peanut.
Oh, right. Yes, it was Peanut, peanut Butter, and Jelly. And then we had a fourth set that no one knew about that was Sandwich, I think?
Donut.
Oh, Donut. Jelly Donut, right. Jelly Donut.
Eventide was Donut.
Yeah, yes. Donut, that's right.
So we kept a secret.
We kept our secret. Okay, so basically a little behind the scenes is Bill had said that he wanted to do four sets in a year. Because previously, like, Cold Snap had been the last time we tried that. And I said to Bill, I go, next time you want four sets, can you tell me ahead of time? I'll build it in. Just tell me when you want four sets. So Bill's like, okay, I want four sets. And the idea I pitched him was the big little plan, where we have two mini blocks that go together. And all we had really, well, I signed you up for a tribal set. That was the one thing we knew going in, was that Lorwyn, the mini block of Lorwyn was going to be tribal focused. Okay, so why don't you pick up the story from, okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, we'd worked with, you know, Brady Dommermuth, who was the creative lead at that time, was on the design team with us. And we were, I don't know if he was the one that came up with the kind of light, dark as the two elements of the two blocks adding together. But anyway, he kind of took that and mapped it onto what he was calling, you know, the Seely and the Unseely courts of like Celtic, I don't know if mythology is the word, but or fairy tales exactly, folklore,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, Celtic folklore.
Folklore with the boggarts and the elves and fairies and things like that. So that was definitely the source material that we were loosely influenced by. We didn't do, this was not like a big top-down set where we studied Celtic folklore and tried to bring all those characters to life or whatnot. It was just like more like, here's a tone, Celtic folklore, light and dark.
And we liked the idea that Lorwyn was kind of the nice set and Shadowmoor was the mean set. Like sort of the part of night and day was light was, it was not kind of, not as scary as the nighttime and a little nicer. And the nighttime, it got very, you know, freaky and scary.
So that niceness of like trying to make this set that was friendlier led us into some strange places. Like Initially, we were just talking about the level of removal should be really low, or removal should be really weak, because you know there's not a lot of killing going on in this world. Like, the goblins are throwing pies at each other, not stabbing each other. Mm-hmm. And that's a really tough thing to try to do in a magic set, you know, where you want the game to progress and things to die, and you don't want the board to become full of 1,000 creatures. Ultimately, I think we did not end up sticking to that, but boy, did we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to make a magic set where there wasn't a lot of, where there was tons of creatures and not a lot of removal.
And so part of that was we were using -1/-1 counters with the flavor of, oh, you're not killing them, you're just injuring them. And then it just became apparent so quickly that, like, it just felt meaner. Like, it didn't feel nicer. And so Persist got actually made an early design, but when we decided to push off the -1/-1 to Shadowmoor, Persist went with it. But Persist was made, who made Persist? It was Nate. Nate made Persist. Nate Heitz made Persist. Yeah.
So all that, right? All that -1/-1 stuff, Persist, Wither, the kind of wounding of stuff, all got moved to Shadowmoor, and we decided to use the beneficial counters, the +1/+1 counters in Lorwyn, which gave us a great mirror, which was, I think, we were putting the two sets together.
So very early on, we sat down, and like you said, Brady was on the team. We carved out the creature types, I think, super, super early.
Yes, that was important in order to figure out what the heck we should be making. Figuring out the tribes, what colors they were in. We needed some that were large creatures, some were small. So we ended up, giants and tree folk were important to make sure we could have big creatures in red and green. We decided we weren't going to do humans. That was going to be a big KSP, or a big thing that made this set stand out from others, was no humans at all. So coming up with whatever the white race was tricky. I don't know where, like, Kithkin were in Legends initially, there's like one card that was a Kithkin.
Yeah.
Kithkin. I don't even know if that word is real or not, or if it's just made up for magic, or if it had predated magic. But somebody said that, I think it might have been Brady that said we should use these as kind of our halflings. They're not human, but they can be civilized and relatable. So that was a kind of a bold move. And the other tribes are more traditional tribal set, elf, goblin, merfolk. Elementals were kind of cool because they filled both the role of the, blue-red small creatures, but also then in five colors across all different shapes and sizes. And we ended up seeding these tribes into the time spiral block. We knew early enough what the eight tribes were going to be, so that showed up on cards in all the time spiral sets to make sure there were some of each already in standard by the time this set came out. So that's why there's some Kithkin rebels in time spiral. There's a couple tree folk, fairies. So, we did a pretty good job of committing and laying those seeds early.
Another thing I want to mention real quick is merfolk. So there was a period in time where the creative team, they didn't like merfolk. They're like, they live in water, we fight on land, this is just sort of weird. And so there's a period of time where they tried to take merfolk out of the game. And that was during Onslaught. And so the tribal set didn't have merfolk in it. And so when we came back and did the next tribal set, we're like, we have to like reclaim merfolk, and we had to we knew that merfolk was very popular. And so I know we brought merfolk back specifically so that we can sort of give them a tribal outing that they hadn't had before.
Right, and they don't have legs. There was a point in time where we were doing them with legs, and here I think they're just much more traditional. So the set that we had kind of looked at for inspiration, obviously, was Onslaught, the one you just mentioned, the tribal set, which was really popular. That came out. That was the set that came out in between when I finished playing and when I got hired. So I didn't get to work on it, but I had waited a bunch and I enjoyed it a lot. And the weird thing about that set, or the weird thing that people don't remember, and I certainly didn't, was that there weren't that many tribal cards in the set. Like, the set was mostly about morph and cycling, honestly, when you played limited, but there were a few like really high-powered, lower-rarity tribal cards like Sparksmith or Timberwatch Elf. Or Noxious Ghoul or whatever, that really paid you for drafting a bunch of a tribe. But
can I explain why that was so, Aaron? The
tribal cards was not that high. Yeah, yeah.
So basically what happened was I was really gung-ho on tribal, and the rest of R&D was not nearly as excited as I was. And they really felt like, oh, this is the morph set. And I remember after the pre-release, there was a meeting where, like, Randy was talking about, like, wow, people really see this as the tribal set and not the morph set. And I'm like, I've been saying this forever. But that is why, everybody didn't really embrace it. You know, I mean, we embraced it. It was in the set. But it wasn't, I think people saw that as being, like, the secondary thing of the set or something. And I really had trouble making them understand that, like, the players just love tribal, that there's something about sticking lots of creatures together that are the same, that's just very lovable.
So I remember we busted out some old Onslaught packs and played sealed deck with Onslaught as preparation, getting ready to work on Lorwyn. And I played a whole match of sealed, and the only tribal interaction that came up in the entire match was my mobilization, which was an enchantment that gave all soldiers vigilance. My mobilization gave my opponent's soldier vigilance. That was the only tribal interaction that came up the whole time we played. And I was like, wow, I'm just misremembering how much of this was in the set, because there was a small number of very focused tribal cards that were very memorable. And that kind of made the whole set feel that way. So with Lorwyn, we decided we were going to kind of go the other way. We were going to make tons and tons of tribal cards that were a little lower synergy level. Like, if you control a giant, you get to do this, or counter on a Kithkin you control or whatever. Just like much lower ceiling effects, but a lot more of them.
Were all the common threshold one?
There were some, like, I remember Silver Guild Dowser was like, tap, give target creature minus X minus O till end of turn, okay, where X is the number of fairies and merfolk you control. So there were some scaling effects. They were not nearly as powerful as Timberwatch Elf and Sparksmith were in Onslaught, but they did exist. But honestly, we went way too far with this.
We did.
Like, the whole set was so tribal. And like every card, once you drafted a Kithkin card, like every other card you took just told you to draft more and more Kithkin. And it got on rails so quickly that there weren't always very many decisions to make in drafting. And it was often just like whose deck had the highest density of stuff that mattered. We thought we were putting in more like branching paths or decks to go in different ways. We had Changelings. That was really cool. Like, we took the Mistform Ultimus ability, which was this really standout card from Onslaught, and decided that was something that could be on tons of cards. So there's tons of Changelings. There's actually Changeling instance and sorceries with the tribal super type, which we can get into if we want to. We have creatures that were like Cloud Goat Ranger is a famous example, where it's a giant that makes three Kithkin. I remember initially in design, I was hoping we could make a card that was a giant Kithkin, meaning it was a giant and a Kithkin, and it was like the giant was the card and the Kithkin were the tokens, but if the tokens died, the giant was still a giant Kithkin, which didn't feel right. So it was just a giant that made Kithkin tokens. We were trying to make cards that branched between tribes, but ultimately that was not enough to overcome the sheer amount of synergy within each tribe. And it was both put you on rails and increase the board complexity by having all these interconnected tribal effects happening all at the same time, which got even worse when we added in Morning Tide with its class tribal. Though that combination of things eventually led us to want to do New World Order. So ultimately what I'm saying is that the amount of tribal interactions that we put in Lorwyn was wrong and too high and too dense. And
so a great plug. Last week I had Matt Place on to talk about New World Order. So if you do not know what that is and want to learn more about it, go listen to my podcast on New World Order.
Yeah, Matt was one of the developers that worked on all these sets.
Okay, so let's talk through some of the mechanics. Do you want to start talking tribal?
Yeah, sure. So tribal is a super type. Is that right? No, it's a card type.
It's a card tribal type. It's a card type.
People say it should be a super type. Yes. And they're probably right. I obviously just misremembered what it was. It's a card type.
Yeah.
It's a bizarre card type. It springs forth from very kind of noble, flavorful goals of like, shouldn't there be elf spells? Like, if there are elf creatures, shouldn't there also be elf spells? Like, wouldn't the spells that elves cast be elf spells? So if you said tutor for an elf spell, you could get, you know, this cool spell that an elf cast. The problem is, like, magic was not set up that way from the beginning. So it was really hard to retrofit it in. And the only way we could come up with something that let us put creature subtypes on non-creature spells was to create a second card type that could have creature subtypes, which was tribal. So all tribal really is a flag that lets you assign creature subtypes to non-creature cards. We did not retroactively go back and errata all the old stuff. We did not make Goblin Grenade a tribal sorcery-goblin. Maybe we were supposed to. If we really wanted this to work, maybe we had to go all in. But I think we were skittish about it. It was a short-lived experiment. We did it here in this block. We did a few more in Rise of the Eldrazi, and that's mostly been it. It was just extra complexity, very weird, hard to explain.
And it turns out that like 80% of the effects you want don't make sense with spells. That a lot of what you're doing is creature-centric. And there are a few effects, like get stuff out of the graveyard. I mean, there are a few effects that interact with it, but
We kind of fell in love with the few that we knew worked really well, like regrow a zombie card. You can get Nameless Inversion, which is a changeling instant back from your graveyard if you regrow a zombie card. And that feels really fun. But like, there's like four or five cards that work that way that are really cool, and the rest is just bizarre. And something we weren't committed to doing full all over the place. And I think ultimately that just doomed it.
Okay, next up, Champion. So Champion, let me read what, when this enters the battlefield, sacrifice it unless you exile another type. So it's Champion A type that you control. When this leaves the battlefield, that card returns to the battlefield. So it would say, like, champion an elf, and it's a creature that when you enter the battlefield, you have to get rid of an elf. The elf kind of turns into it, but when it dies, you get the elf back.
Right, so we have long looked for mechanics, and we continue to do so, that show, like, creatures leveling up or evolving into bigger things or whatever. You know, if anyone's played Pokemon, you know, the feeling of turning your Charmander into a Charmeleon and then into a Charizard is really cool. So why couldn't Magic play in that space as well? Just, here's my small guy, and I turn him into a big, awesome version of himself. I actually think the mechanic's pretty fun. It requires a real high density of the thing that you're championing in order for the card to work at all. So some of the more successful ones were the changelings that just championed a creature, to any creature. But yeah, we got to write some ridiculous text on some of these cards, you know, the 10-2 for 4 mana or whatever, Nova Chaser. I thought it was pretty fun. When they died, you got to reuse your comes into play effects, enter the battlefield effects as they're known now.
Yeah, we started, by the way, with a card became an exact, like, kind of like what you were saying. Like, this creature becomes that creature. And it was just way too restrictive, and it just never happened. And so that's when we said, okay, well, we're a tribal set. What if, you know,
Meaning, like, you had to upgrade your...
Yeah, like, this specific creature became that specific creature.
Became Kithkin Master Armor or whatever. Like,
yes.
Exactly card A and card B. Okay,
right, and...
I don't remember that.
I mean, it was very, very early on, but we learned really quickly that it just was too restrictive. And so then we leaned into, okay, well, what if it's any of a certain creature type that upgrades? So that felt like you know, you're already, we're make, asking you to build your deck around creature type, so we felt like that was more something that people could do. So next on my list here is Changeling. So we brought up Changeling. So Changeling says, technically, this card is every creature type at all times. It was, in fact, based on the Moonfolk. Moonfolk Ultimus. Misform Ultimus. So what happened was I had made Misform Ultimus back in Onslaught block because I was just trying to be interactive with the theme at the time. And I know this came in about the middle of the playtest, middle of the design, where I recognized we didn't have enough glue. And so Aaron and I would talk all the time. And I pitched, well, what if we put Misform Ultimus in the set? And I know the creative team wasn't happy about it because they had to figure out some way to make it work creatively. And they didn't want them to be straight up shapeshifters because they felt that changed the story too much. Like, if there were race of creatures that could just look like anybody, it so dominated what the story would want to be. And so they came up with, we joked about the Jell-O molds, the green see-through creatures.
Yeah, the art on them is pretty ridiculous. If you look at something like Avian Changeling, it's like a goose with the goofy see-through head or whatever. It's yeah, they're their own race. They can approximate other creatures, I guess, in the flavor. Yeah. In the story, in gameplay, they just are all creature types. The creative solve was, I think, executed a little goofily. I mean, the whole set kind of has that tone, but I think the mechanic was good. In fact, we brought it back both in Modern Horizons 1 and in Kaldheim, and the execution on both of those sets creatively is actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to chalk this up as a win. Obviously, we've come back to it multiple times.
Oh, I think Changeling is a great tool.
It always works really well whenever we do it.
Yeah, I think Changeling is a great tool. Okay, next up, I'm going alphabetically here. Clash. So Clash says, each clashing player reveals the top card of their library, then puts that card on top or bottom. A player wins if their card had a higher converted mana cost.
Such, yeah, I'm not exactly sure how we got to this point. I mean, it is a kind of card flow mechanic, meaning whenever I cast a Clash spell, I do get to, much like Explore and Ixalan, decide if I want to keep the next card I'm about to draw, which can be good. I think it might have had to do with kind of that we don't want actual violence, so we're just kind of like sparring with each other. It was tough to balance the card because you didn't want, like, my removal spell didn't work because of what was randomly on top of my opponent's deck. So I don't know. This one, obviously, we haven't ever come back to, so it clearly did not work great. I don't know what recollection you have of it, but
we had high hopes because we're like, oh, it smooths your mana, so it helps everybody and makes the gameplay better. And one of the things about Tribal is there's a lot of synergy connections. Like, you want to draw the right cards and stuff. And so, like, having a smoothing mechanic really helped that. But, yeah, in the end, we had high hopes, and it really was, the audience was not a big fan of Clash.
Yeah, I mean, and as a designer, I'm always looking for, like, little moments, little victories you can have, even if you don't win the whole game, that, like, you accomplish some small goal. And I guess I thought this might feel that way, where it's just like, well, you beat me, but we did have that cool turn where we clashed and I won and something good happened. But, like, it's just so random. Like, it's just like literally playing war. Like, flip the top card up. Who did? It's not like, ooh, I've really cleverly won the clash.
Yeah, cards in to help you, but yeah, it mostly was just random.
Yeah, like ponder or whatever. Yeah, we wanted. Obviously, we tried to allow you to min-max the clash result, but often it was just you had to cast spells on curve whenever you could afford to, and randomly things happened or not. And it was not particularly rewarding.
Okay, next up, Evoke. So this Evoke goes on creatures that haven't entered the battlefield effect, at least in Lorwyn. I think they had to leave the battlefield effect in Morningtide. And then there's mana you could pay, and if you pay it, they stick around. Otherwise, they sack at end of turn. So the idea behind these were they could be spells or creatures. In my original design for these, they were spells, and you paid to turn them into creatures, but the rules at the time did not want us to do that, so the workaround was to make them creatures with ETBs that left at the end of turn if you didn't pay
for them. Yeah, I remember, spell shooters or something. We wanted a terror effect, and then it could turn into a creature that was like an embodiment of terror.
Yeah.
Ultimately, that became Shriek Maw, was the card we actually printed. I like the mechanic. Yeah, it's quite powerful. You can use it as a spell early, and then later on, once you have enough mana, the creatures are all basically two-for-ones. We skinned all them as elementals, so they were kind of embodiments of different spells. The creative was like they were just mashups of different creatures. It's like a ladybug with a pig head or something, just, you know, all really strange looking things.
This is one of those mechanics that I'm always on the lookout. Like, I would love to bring Evoke back. I need to find the right place and whatever, but it's definitely on my list of one day we should do it again. I'm a big fan of Evoke.
Yeah, we used it in Modern Horizons 2 to incredible effect. The some of the most powerful cards in that set are mythic creatures that evoke by discarding or exiling a card of their color. Like Solitude and Grief and Fury. So, yes, Evoke is a mechanic that I expect we will be using quite a bit going forward.
Okay, last mechanic, named mechanic, Hideaway. So this has a really interesting origin. I guess you want to tell it this was your mechanic.
Yeah, I mean, as a first-time big set lead, I mean, I was trying to put stuff in the set that I wanted to put in Magic for a long time. And like I said about, I like little mini games with rewards. And so I was trying to make a mechanic that was kind of captured the feeling of searching for hidden treasure or digging up treasure. So there was for a long time in design, there was a series of cards where some of them had a treasure mechanic, which was exile the top card of your library underneath a land you control. So just kind of stash a card under one of your lands. And then there's another mechanic that, I don't know if it was called Dig or Dig Up Treasure, that let you pay some mana and tap the creature and the land to get the card into your hand. So basically you draw a card. And it was flavorful and cute. And it was a lot of steps and a lot of words and two different mechanics on different cards. And Eric Lauer, who was pretty new to the department at the time, was just like, if I can do this, why would I ever do anything else with my creatures? Let me just draw cards all day and I won't ever attack or block. And it's just too much. It's too much. And that was sad. He was right, but it was sad. So I was hell-bent on figuring out how to get something in this vibe of like, can I play a land that stashes a card, puts me on a little quest, and then whenever I complete the quest, I get the card. And the Hideaway lands, Sheldock Isle and Spine Rock Knoll and the rest were that. And I actually like how those cards turned out.
Yeah, no, I it's funny how much iteration that treasure went through, but I do think in the end, Hideout was kind of fun, so... But that started as a very major mechanic that was throughout the set at all rarities and ended up being cycle at rare. So.
Yeah, and actually we're going to probably see that mechanic again soon, if I remember correctly. So it's not one that we use a lot, but I'm happy to see that it had some legs. And treasure obviously is something the concept was powerful. We turned it into tokens, like little lotus petal tokens that we use quite often now. So I'm glad we found a good use for that word and that concept, because it is powerful and very fantasy and cool. That's how Hideaway came about.
Okay, so I can see my desk here, so almost to work.
But you forgot one big mechanic.
Oh, what did I forget?
Planeswalker.
Oh, Planeswalker! Okay, let's talk, that's right. That is a big mechanic. Let's talk Planeswalker.
I'm sure we've told this story before.
We have, but we get to tell stories more than once. That's my specialty.
Originally, these things were meant to go in Future Sight. They're exactly the kind of gag that Future Sight was hot hot to trot on, you know, new card types. We had wanted as a brand to find ways to have characters that could persist from world to world. You know, it was something we felt we lacked. We'd always tell a story in a world, go to another world, all new characters. The players were planeswalkers, but we had nobody we could show on cards. We did great work. Creative team, Alexi Bricklow, the artist, came up. Did the original Lorwyn 5 are just awesome characters. I'm glad they ended up in Lorwyn instead of Future Sight, so they had a whole large set to shine in. That said, they're pretty out of place, right? They're not part of the story. They're like the only humans in the whole world. We didn't explain anything about who they were or why they were there. They didn't like solve the problems of Lorwyn or whatever. Right. So
they were not involved in the story at all.
Yeah, pretty weird that they're there. But those cards stand up pretty well. For the first attempt at us not really understanding them all that well, like Jace Beleren and Chandra Nalar and Garrick Wildspeaker are quite fantastically developed and designed. And man, they, I'm glad they were too, because they set Planeswalkers down, set us on a path where Planeswalkers are just such a huge part of our game and our IP. And I think a lot of it is because how well we executed those first five.
And by the way, making a brand new card type is no easy business, right? That like the fact that they came off as well as they did. I mean, given we took a while working on them, but
there were versions of them that played more like sagas, where they would just kind of procedurally go through their list of abilities and then start back at the beginning. There were versions that were like landscape, where they were sitting on the table sideways. They kind of look more like driver's licenses than magic cards. Tons and tons of iteration. So many knobs, as we like to say in development, like so many things you can change to tweak the power level of these cards. They have so many numbers on them, so many words on them. They're really hard to make. And the graphic design was new, and the rules new. And
They all worked out.
It worked out phenomenally. Really proud of those.
So I realized there's one last thing I wanted to ask you about. These were one of your babies. So you have always loved choice. You love charms. You like anything that gives you choice. And I know we had charms had showed up in Mirage, and then we'd done them a bunch of times. But I know you got inspired. So talk a little bit about there's a very famous cycle from the set that it was your baby.
Yeah, the commands. So cryptic command, profane command, etc. Austere command. I love modes. I love modal cards. I remember even working on Fifth Dawn, which was the first design team I was on, made mode men. I wanted to have just creatures that were ETB charms. And we've since made a bunch of those, but so we were looking to make, like, one thing Bill Rose would always ask us of, like, what's the theme of your set? Okay, it's tribal. Okay, what do you have for people that don't like your theme? That's always a question he's asking, like, are people going to want any of the cards in your set if they don't like tribal, or they don't like this art style, or they don't like whatever it is, like the main course is, what do you have for them? So, okay, if people don't like creatures, or people don't like weenie decks, or whatever it is we're pushing, let's make a rare spell cycle that's new and different. And instead of just choosing one from a list, like choose two from a list. It's a simple change, but it was pretty eye-opening and opened up the combinatorics of any given card a ton, and they felt very flexible and cool and novel. And we have gone back to that well quite a few times since. It's a real simple thing that I think had a high ceiling and paid off really well, and those cards are, especially Cryptic Command, have gone on to become quite famous.
Yeah, it's the thing I always love is when you change one thing, like just saying instead of three pick one, four pick two, doesn't seem like that different, but it is, you know, just the way it plays, it's quite different. So I love finding stuff like that. But
really proud of that cycle as well.
So any final
thing? I'm really proud of this.
Yeah, proud of the cycle. It's an awesome cycle.
We learned a lot working on it. Both on like what to do and what not to do. We still talk about it all the time. There's so many examples of things that went right and things that went wrong. The things that went right went really right. The things that went wrong went really wrong. I imagine one day we're going to come back and kind of give it a fresh coat of paint and take all the lessons we've learned and make a new version of Lorwyn, a new take on Lorwyn. I think we could talk people into that. It's got to be a cool idea.
Well, I've been pitching Return of Lorwyn forever, so I'm happy to hear you say that. So
yeah. There's lovable stuff here.
Yeah, it's interesting looking back. One of the things that's always one of the reasons I love doing the look backs on the podcast is, like, this was a while ago, right? Lorwyn was when did Lorwyn come out?
07.
So it's 15 years ago. Yeah. And the set, like, did a lot of things for the first time and really claimed a lot of space and did cool things. And it also made some classic mistakes that sort of taught us not to do that and go in different directions. Like, yeah, this block inspired New World Order. This and Time Spiral inspired New World Order. And it's neat. I don't know. I love looking back and seeing. I don't know. It's fun. It's fun looking back.
Oh, yeah.
So, any final thoughts about Lorwyn before we head off for?
Well, I'm sure we can talk about Morning Tide, or you can talk to Mike Tyrion about Morning Tide. But you know that it's for all the craziness we did here, like we kind of doubled down on it as we figured out our block plan of like we're going to care about different parts of the card. We're going to care about the race in Lorwyn. We're going to care about the class in Morning Tide, and we're going to care about the mana costs. You know, it was just we the whole block added up. In a pretty crazy way.
Yeah, it did. It did. It's funny. There's a lot of decisions that I made. Like, let's have Morning Tide be about class. Let's change up what colors are what creature types between the two mini blah. Anyway, a lot of decisions I made. I look back, I'm like, okay, what was I doing? But
you were trying stuff.
Yeah, I was trying stuff. So, but anyway, it was a lot of fun. It's fun. Thanks for joining me, Aaron. It's fun reminiscing.
Yeah,
I do like. Who was on the team with us? Like
Andrew Finch, Brady,
and Nate
Heitz,
yeah.
Paul Sotosanti, who was ended up being their lead of Morning Tide, and you and I. Yeah.
So I guess you and I are the remaining members of the Lorwyn.
Yep, that's right.
So, but anyway, okay. I can see my desk, guys, so we all know what that means. I mean, this is the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. So thank you, Aaron, for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And for all you, I will see you next time. Bye-bye.